Okay. Hello, I am Representative Connie Bernardi, and welcome to our Senate File 975 Higher Education Omnibus Conference Committee. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting to order. The committee legislative assistant will take the role.
Chair Bernardi.
Present.
Bernardi, present. Representative Christensen.
Present.
Christensen, present. Representative O'Neill.
Present.
O'Neill, present. Representative Keeler.
Present.
Keeler, present. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, present.
Cleavorn, present. Chair Tomasoni.
Here.
Tomasoni, present. Senator Rarick.
Present.
Rarick, present. Senator Clausen.
Present.
Clausen, present. Senator Goggin. And Senator Jasinski.
Here.
Jasinski, present. And a quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Today we will be hearing public testimony on Senate File 975. In addition to the testifiers we have on the call today, members will find additional written testimonies in their packets and posted on the Higher Education Committee page. We have a number of testifiers on the list today, and I will ask everyone to keep their testimony to 2 to 3 minutes to make sure that everyone has signed up gets a chance to speak. I'll ask that members who have questions or comments to please hold them until the end to ensure we give everyone a chance to speak. If we run out of time for all the questions, we can always invite testifiers to join us again in the future. Our testifiers on the list, the first one on the list is Commissioner Olson from the Office of Higher Education. Welcome to our committee today. Go ahead, Commissioner Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Tomasoni and members as well, for the opportunity to join you and share some brief remarks on behalf of the Office of Higher Education today. I want to thank you all for the courtesy, the hard work, and of course the concern for higher education that you and your House and Senate staff have shown as you have processed your omnibus bills to conference committee thus far. This is a critical moment for post-secondary education in the state of Minnesota, as we all want to mitigate the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic while continuing to work toward closing Minnesota's educational attainment gaps. With the state projecting a budget surplus, now is the time to make smart and strategic investments in post-secondary education. We are grateful to see many of the governor's policy recommendations included in both the House and Senate bills. Both the House and Senate bills propose modest language changes to improve the implementation of policies and programs at the Office of Higher Education related to financial aid programs, students needing child care assistance, teacher candidates, workers impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic, and student and consumer protection. The House bill also includes additional consumer protection provisions related to institutional risk analysis, which is unfortunately absent from the Senate bill. This language is critically important to protect students from the potentially devastating impacts of an abrupt closure of an institution. We do appreciate that both the House and the Senate recognize the need to continue to invest in the Minnesota State Grant Program, which currently helps nearly 80,000 low and middle income students attend the college of their choice. While both bills propose an increase to the program, the House proposal closely aligns with the governor's recommendation to invest in the living and miscellaneous expense, which benefits all students, ensuring they have the adequate funding to cover more of the costs associated with going to college. We also agree with the House proposal that allows for increased funds to be targeted toward lower income independent students and adult learners and dependent students whose families earn less than $60,000 per year, which is also in alignment with the governor's recommendation. We are pleased to see that both the House and the Senate bills establish multiple new programs designed to address student basic needs and access, such as the Hunger Free Campus Act and Direct Admissions Minnesota. These are important initiatives that have the potential to greatly improve equity and access, but they need to be implemented and administered effectively. We appreciate that the House bill supports the appropriate agency administrative costs associated with the implementation of these new programs and also includes the governor's recommendation for an inflationary increase for the Office of Higher Education's agency administrative budget. Finally, you'll hear today from both public systems about their specific needs and how they've utilized federal funds thus far, so I won't belabor the point. But as we've all heard, a critical area for investment is in the Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota systems. Both systems have spent the last year facing budget challenges incurred by a rapid transition to distance learning models, added costs associated with protecting the health and safety of students, faculty, and staff during a pandemic, and reduced enrollment. While both systems received federal support through the CARES and CRISA Act, we all know that 50% of those funds went directly to students at a time when students most needed financial support. The remaining funds were specifically designated to be used on costs associated with the pandemic, including lost revenue and expenses already incurred. So those additional funds should not be used to support the ongoing operations and maintenance costs for both systems. Based on the limited guidance we have available right now regarding the ARP Act, the same limitations are likely. It is now the state's turn to continue to support these institutions as they provide world-class educations to Minnesotans from every corner of the state. To fail to adequately support public post-secondary institutions will unfortunately lead to avoidable cuts in programs, services, faculty, and staff that will cause long-term harm to our institutions and the students they serve. Thank you for the opportunity to advocate for the needs of all Minnesota's post-secondary students and their families. We continue at the Office of Higher Education to be grateful for the excellent working relationship between our staff and your talented, hardworking teams, and look forward to the conference committee process as the session proceeds to a successful, timely conclusion. Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. And what I'd like to do is, before we proceed, is I'd like to ask members to write down their questions and hold them for the end to make sure that we get through all of our public testimony today. So thank you very much, Commissioner Olson. Now we have up Paul Cirkvenek, and on deck is Karina Verbitsky. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cirkvenek.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you, Chair Tomasoni and members of the committee. My name is Paul Cirkvenek, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Private College Council. I want to begin by thanking you for the time you've taken to listen to testimony from many students in your respective committees and to visit individually with students who are recipients of the Minnesota State Grant. Their message is a powerful one. The Minnesota State Grant makes a transformative difference in their educational journey. We recognize that you will be making important decisions about how to allocate the limited dollars that are available to the higher education budget to address a range of concerns and needs that include the cost of college, student debt, the economic and educational disparities in our state, the funding requests of the public institutions, and the need in our economy for a highly educated workforce. We are grateful that both the House and the Senate have invested some of the funding available to them in the Minnesota State Grant Program. As you work to address the many needs, we ask that you make the Minnesota State Grant Program a priority for a meaningful appropriation increase within whatever spending target you receive. All students do not have an equal need for financial support in paying for college. All students do not struggle equally with student debt. And all students do not struggle equally in completing a college degree. Paying for college and completing a college degree is much harder for students from families with fewer resources to pay for college. That is, families with incomes below the median household income. In Minnesota, that median household income is about $86,000. These are the students that are served by the Minnesota State Grant Program. 43% of all students receive a Minnesota State Grant. 56% of students of color receive a state grant, and more than 60% of Black students and Native American students receive a state grant. And 68% of all state grant recipients have incomes below $50,000, and 88% have a family income below $80,000. State grant recipients are the students who face the highest barriers to enrolling in college and completing a post-secondary certificate associate's degree, or bachelor's degree. They are the students that show up in Minnesota's degree attainment gap statistics, and within them is the talent that employers in Minnesota need. With limited state resources, you can make the biggest impact on college affordability, student debt, degree completion, closing of educational disparities, and developing the workforce talent our state needs by making a significant new investment in the Minnesota State Grant Program. It's for these reasons that we ask you to use a fair share of the new funding that is available to provide a meaningful increase in the state grant above the level students are receiving for the current year. The pandemic economy has been especially hard on state grant recipients and their families, and their need for an increase in their ongoing financial aid is very real. We ask that you meet this need by a state grant funding increase so that next fall students receive a larger grant than they are currently receiving. Thank you for considering our hopes for this bill and for your commitment to the educational success of low-income and middle-income Minnesota students. Thank you.
Now we're going to move on to Verena Verbitsky, and we have on deck Shanti Armijo Cruz. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Verbitsky.
Hello, Madam Chair, Conference Committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on higher education funding in front of the Conference Committee. My name is Karina Verbitsky, and I am a senior at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. I am majoring in legal studies with Spanish and philosophy minors. I am the Legislative Affairs Chair for the Minnesota Association of Private College Students. At MAPSIS, students from 17 private nonprofit colleges collaborate monthly to search for ways to assist in and advocate for the improvement of campuses and the students who attend them. One of our main objectives is to extend the reach of the Minnesota State Grant to fuel this improvement. You should all have received a letter signed by 13 student leaders from MAPSIS institutions urging new investment in the state grant. When students receive the Minnesota State Grant, they not only obtain the financial assistance needed to be successful in higher education, but also the backing of the state government, which encourages them to achieve their dreams. In fact, we want to extend the reach of the state grant, a program which is one of few that is offered to private college students and one that promotes equity, with 56% of students of color in Minnesota receiving the state grant. For this reason, we believe continued investment into the grant is extremely valuable. On top of the already growing need for new investment in the grant, the effects of COVID-19 have only increased this need. Various jobs that typically supplement student income, such as retail work or restaurant work, were less attainable due to the pandemic closures, yet a large number of college students did not qualify for stimulus checks. Many students were also required to give some, if not all, of their income back to their families while workers were laid off and furloughed. COVID-19 affected all the people of Minnesota, but college students suffered a harsh financial hit, many having to sacrifice their college savings to stay afloat. MAPSIS students are also very supportive of the hunger-free campus language included in the bill. We would ask that matching grants be open to our colleges if they meet the designation criteria. It is difficult to succeed at school if you are hungry or worried about where you will find your next meal, an issue that has only grown since the onset of COVID-19. An investment in the Minnesota State Grant and hunger-free campuses is truly an investment in the future of Minnesota and our nation. It is an investment in equity and opportunity. It is an investment that will allow student leaders to succeed and someday sit in positions just like yours, positions that can truly make positive change. Thank you for supporting Minnesota students and the Minnesota State Grant. Thank you for supporting the next generation of innovators and leaders. I will now turn it over to Shanti Armijo Cruz from the College of St. Scholastica, who will share her state grant story. Thank you.
Thank you. And welcome to the committee, Ms. Armijo Cruz. And on deck, I want to let you know that it is Myron France. Go ahead. Thank you and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. I appreciate you all for letting me speak this afternoon. So my name is Chantal Armijo Cruz, and I'm currently a senior at the College of St. Scholastica. Well, I'll be graduating in just 2 weeks with a dual bachelor's degree in social work and psychology. And post-graduation, I'll be training to work as a behavior technician at Behavior Frontiers. So the past 4 years at St. Scholastica, I've been involved in numerous social justice clubs, from Latinx Student Union to Asian Student Union, Black Student Union, and also student government. And this past year, I served as student body president, and I've been advocating for the Minnesota State Grant since my freshman year. So 4 years later, I cannot stress enough how valuable and impactful the Minnesota State Grant is for various communities, but specifically Black, Indigenous, and people of color, so BIPOC. So myself as a first-generation student and a child of immigrants, you know, the application process is an unknown territory, but the price tag is very discouraging for some. Following a family legacy at a prestigious university is an option, and the price tag isn't very discouraging, doesn't mean anything, right? But meanwhile, I depended on scholarships and financial aid, such as the Minnesota State Grant, to achieve a higher education, to have a better future, to achieve the American dream, right? The American dream that can drive students into debt without more financial aid. So education should not be a privilege. There is a huge barrier to education that is rooted in the lack of funds for many Minnesota recipients. So continuing to fund this program will allow many to further their education and bridge the gap. It is because of this Minnesota State Grant that I, along with five of my cousins, we were able to afford to attend college all at the same time. And unfortunately, I can't say the same for many folks. And I ask you to please continue to increase funding for Minnesota State Grant to support Minnesotan students and support the next generation of leaders and scholars. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Now on deck is Dr. Jacob Tolar, and with us right now, and welcome to the committee, Myron France.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi and Chair Tomasoni and members of the conference committee. For the record, my name is Myron Franz, and I'm the Senior Vice President for Finance and Operations at the University of Minnesota. I appreciate the time to speak with you this afternoon. It's good to see you all again. You know for certain that it is May in Minnesota when you're scheduled to testify before a legislative conference committee. On behalf of the University of Minnesota, I want to thank you and your staff for the time spent with us this session in developing your higher education omnibus bills. We stand ready to partner with you throughout this process. But I also want to thank Governor Walz, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, Office of Higher Education Commissioner Olson for their support of higher education in Minnesota. Today, I will share our positions on some of the provisions in the House and Senate bills. You should also have a copy of a letter from President Gabel that outlines our view of the key features of both bills. In January, President Joan Gable presented the university's 22-23 biennial budget request, where she outlined our $46.5 million appropriation request. As she noted then, our request is designed to address our most pressing needs as identified in our system-wide strategic plan, the first time the university has ever taken this particular approach. Our request prioritized the funding we believe is necessary to continue our mission of teaching, research, and service. First, we appreciate the increased funding levels included in both the House and Senate bills and the focus you have placed on the importance of our students and their future successes, the future success of Minnesota. The amount of funding, however, does not fully fund our request. As a result, there will be some consequential impacts on our students and employees across the system. The Senate level of funding is particularly concerning. The level provided is simply not enough to meet the future needs of our system. The current level of appropriation in the House and Senate bills will make it difficult for the university to move forward as we climb out of the pandemic. It is increasingly difficult to support our employees, keep tuition costs low, address important needs across our system, and further research in areas like natural resources, healthcare, and agriculture without state support of our full request. The House bill includes a $2 million one-time investment for the Natural Resources Research Institute, or NRRI. While the work at NRRI is very important to our state, the board did not request this funding, and because neither the House nor the Senate bills meet the board's full request, we respectfully ask that you prioritize the Board of Regents' request before funding other University of Minnesota programs. It is very concerning to see a reduction in funding in the Senate bill for Regenerative Medicine Minnesota, or RMM. This program targets research and medical needs that are critical to Minnesotans, such as heart disease, diabetes, obesity, liver disorders, and neurodegenerative disorders. You will hear more about the importance of RMM from Dr. Tolar, Dean of the Medical School, and Dr. Terzic from Mayo Clinic. Finally, I would like to share our thoughts on funds from the federal government, which have been appropriated to help us close historic pandemic-driven shortfalls in our fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 21 budgets. While we are still waiting for final guidance from the federal government, as Commissioner Olson mentioned, we do know that roughly one half of the federal funding will go to students directly as required. The federal funding is not discretionary and must be spent on pandemic-related losses. The Senate provision is encouraging us to use federal funds to cover a 3% tuition reduction and provide one-time COVID-19 risk stipends may not be compliant with federal intent and would only serve to increase our $235 million shortfall. In fact, the funding we have or will receive from the institutional portions of the three federal funding bills, the portion coming to our campuses and not to students directly, does not even cover the university's losses. In fact, this still leaves the university $131 million short. We have aggressively begun tackling that shortfall, reducing our deficit by over $84 million through budget cuts, the use of university reserves, hiring freezes, and by the majority of our employees taking temporary pay cuts. We have asked a tremendous amount of the people that make the University of Minnesota strong. Finally, we are grateful to you and your staff for the support of the University of Minnesota. We urge you to prioritize funding our full request as you continue in your conference negotiations, and we stand ready to respond to any questions you may have. Thank you, Chair Bernardi and Chair Tomassoni and the entire members of the conference committee.
Thank you very much. We are going to, on deck is Dr. Andre Terzic, and we have joining us now Dr. Jacob Tolar. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I feel I am among friends. Chair Bernardi, Chair Tomassoni, members of the Higher Education Conference Committee, I am Jacob Tolar. I serve you and the state and the University of Minnesota as a Dean of Medical School and Vice President for Clinical Affairs. I am truly grateful for your time today. It's an honor and a privilege to serve you in this way. For the Regenerative Medicine Minnesota, the goal is to provide the best possible care for Minnesotans. If you look at medicine at large, this is probably the most glorious accomplishment of mankind. It only takes a reflection of about 100 years back to look at what the life has been before antibiotics, before anesthesia, before all the advancements we have. Now, the challenge for the Regenerative Medicine Minnesota and its goal in the way we, with your help, have positioned it to amplify the research, the industry, and the innovation in care delivery in Minnesota is in the way that we have all these dots of brilliance. This Mayo Clinic, University of Minnesota, industry in the state, these brilliant minds, and you have, with this bill, with this effort, you have helped us connect the dots and catalyze something that has not been here before, which is the quest to harness the regenerative body ability of the body to repair itself. There's probably nothing better in medicine than that. Let me give you two examples. I'm a bone marrow transplant physician, oncologist. I treat children and adults with cancer for a living. Dr. Holtan has received one of these grants in the regenerative medicine in Minnesota, and she targeted one of the most difficult complications that I deal with in the bone marrow transplant unit, and that's called graft versus host disease. Doesn't matter what it means. What it really is, something like rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or something autoimmune, that the immune system gets misdirected and misunderstands, misremembers its history and attacks its own tissues. She has been able to bring a low-cost, low-intensity, simple hormone treatment to take the rate of this complication in half. Okay, that's statistic. That's math. Simple, but statistic. What it really means is if you have graft versus host disease, after you have been diagnosed with leukemia or lymphoma, survive that oncology disorder, you may still live the life of misery, because from the pain changes that are in the skin, in the bones, difficulty to eat, difficulty to live in freedom of a healthy body, what it means is that that simple intervention that you supported can change somebody's life and can change her ability to get back to her family, back to her community, and back to who she is. A number of the patients that have developed this graft versus host disease complications have such a deep-seated pain. It's a bone pain that you cannot scratch, that you cannot get relief, you know, with the normal medications. And that led them, many of my patients included, to addiction. And then you have another problem. So this is a game-changing, life-changing intervention. Let me give you another one. In this state, as the bone marrow transplant has been the first ever performed successfully in this state, also the open heart surgery for the congenital heart defect have been performed in this state. We have a tremendous legacy in what preceded the regenerative medicine Minnesota. What it means, however, that you can turn your child, your grandchild, or your neighbor's child, for that matter, from a blue baby that's going to die at 2 days or 2 years of age, into somebody who's going to survive it. The challenge, though, is that you may need to go and reoperate that valve or that piece of the heart, that vessel, every year, every second year, until she grows up in her later teens or young adulthood. And that is, any surgery, you know, is phenomenally traumatic. It's less traumatic for me as a surgeon. It's much more traumatic for the patient. And I can guarantee you that every single patient I've ever seen in the operating room is scared. And the family is scared. So if you bring that 2-year-old, that 4-year-old, that 6-year-old to the operating room and reoperate, this is a tremendous drawback, setback in her life, in her family. And now Dr. Tranquillo, based on the one of the grants that the Regenerative Medicine Minnesota supported, has developed a way that the graft, that little valve, that little piece of vessel, grows with the child. That's amazing if you think about this, because that is harnessing the regenerative potential of the body to benefit the patient, the family, and the community. Good, right? All right. So the questions were about how is this funding distributed. Out of the $4.35 million that we get every year for this distribution, at least $3 million every year went to the Discovery Science. These are the projects that I just talked about and very similar ones. It's more than 3/4 of that funding. About 15% went to the biobusiness. This is really important. If you look at the power of industry and engineering in the state, in the private hands and the connectivity with the academic institutions such as Mayo Clinic and University of Minnesota, we have something that we have to use to the advantage of the health of the Minnesotans. But
Dr. Tolar? Oh, you're looking up in heaven. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. I don't know where you're looking. You're looking up. So okay. If you could wrap up, I would really appreciate it. I appreciate your enthusiasm and your testimony.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. I got carried away. Chair Bernardi, other members, in 2020, Office of Legislative Auditor issued a report of RMM. We responded to all the recommendations. We stopped funding the educational grants, and we now are able to really get going. But I am here to ask that you adopt the House position on base funding and that you let us do what we do well. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have on deck Bill Mackey, and we have up now Dr. Andre Terzic. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, distinguished members. Thank you so much for the opportunity to address the committee today. My name is Andre Terzic. I'm a physician researcher at Mayo Clinic, where I direct the Center for Regenerative Medicine. along with my distinguished colleagues, Dr. Tolar from the University of Minnesota, we have had the privilege to jointly direct and indeed to steward the program Regenerative Medicine Minnesota, which since its inception in 2014 has been highly successful in its mission to improve, as you have just heard, the health of Minnesota by advancing regenerative discovery and regenerative medicine. The program is indeed very unique as it focuses on providing grants and emphasizing economic opportunities for the state by developing and deploying truly novel, transformative breakthrough technologies that strengthen Minnesota's position as a leader in regenerative medicine, both nationwide but also globally. Indeed, Regenerative Minnesota is particularly focused on taking those promising discoveries all the way to the patients through a process that we call clinical trials, where trusted, validated therapies are being tested in patients in need. Indeed, this allows acceleration of commercial events, of the research that underpins this innovation, and it allows also applications much more quickly for patient care. This acceleration thus delivers great benefits to care, but also provides a unique impetus for an economic potential positioning Minnesota as many of you have called it, the epicenter of regenerative medicine and the future of medicine. It was already alluded that the main thrust and the main resources are being provided for diseases particularly common in Minnesota, namely heart disease, cancer, diabetes, lung disorders, brain disease, spinal cord injury, musculoskeletal disorder, kidney failure, indeed the most prevalent conditions that afflicts our Minnesotans. Well, we understand that the state has limited resources. We strongly believe that a program like Regenerative Medicine Minnesota are essential in both preserving and growing Minnesota's leadership in medical research and innovation, and indeed a key driver of the state's economy and job market. Limiting state funding will severely compromise regenerative medicine in Minnesota and the benefits it confers to Minnesota and Minnesotans. We hope you agree that this program is indeed vital for the present, but also for the future of the state's scientific, economic, and public health, and for its unique position within the nation and indeed, as mentioned, globally. As you continue the budget process, we ask you, therefore, to please restore full funding to the budget, and we take one more time the opportunity to thank you for all your support and indeed for your consideration today. Thank you.
Thank you. On deck, we have Paul Shepherd, and with us now is Bill Mackey. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Chair Bernardi, Chair Tomasoni, members of the conference committee, for the record, I am Bill Mackey, Vice Chancellor for Finance and facilities with Minnesota State. Thank you again for the opportunity to provide testimony on the higher education omnibus bill. Minnesota State stands ready to be your partner as you work through this important process and passing a bill that supports students and supports the financial health of our 54 campuses and the communities we serve. I also want to again thank staff in helping us through these deliberations. Minnesota State's biennial budget request is focused on two main priorities, campus responsiveness and stabilization, and equity and affordability. It is clear from the discussion in the two previous conference committee meetings that many of these initiatives align with these priorities. In my testimony, I'll attempt to cover some of the topics and questions that have been raised in previous committee meetings, including online differential tuition refunds, faculty stipends, federal stimulus funds, and the financial concerns of cutting or freezing ongoing tuition revenue using one-time federal funding. I will start with the guidance provided to our campuses regarding online tuition rates 1 year ago in the midst of the pandemic. First, I'd like to mention that in the spring and summer of 2020, Minnesota State graduated 26,000 students with degrees and certificates in many high needs areas. We were able to do this because Minnesota State built an online instructional delivery system that goes back decades. In a matter of days, 95% of our in-person classes were converted online during spring semester 2020. And for those students whose in-person courses abruptly shifted to online, there was no additional tuition cost to them for that semester. The summer 2020 guidance that was provided to the colleges and universities for this academic year was straightforward. If a class was designed to be part of the college or university's online portfolio going forward, the online differential rate would apply. If the course was simply converted for delivery during the pandemic, those rates would not apply. We believe that we approach this in a thoughtful manner. It's also important to remember that these decisions were made during the height of the pandemic with great uncertainty as to its duration or its impact on course delivery. In regards to faculty stipends, I want to first say all of us should be proud of the work that over 15,000 faculty and staff at your Minnesota State colleges and universities have done throughout the pandemic. It is graduation season starting this week, and in the next few, over the next few, several days, 35,000 students will be Minnesota State 2021 graduates and will enter the workforce in communities across Minnesota. We are grateful that none of our Minnesota State campuses had significant COVID outbreaks. I attribute that to the dedicated employees as well as students who did their part in getting us to today. We have dedicated faculty and staff who have shown up on campus every day over the past 14 months, helping to keep our campuses safe and going the extra mile to make sure our students can learn and faculty can teach in a safe environment. We have many colleagues across the system that have done their part to help students continue on their educational journey. You have also heard from us over the years that we believe tuition should be set by the Board of Trustees, which is one of their responsibilities prescribed in statute. Having said that, we know that you are committed to college affordability for students. We share that commitment, which is why we are continually focused on affordability initiatives, such as our Z-Degree initiative we brought forward and is supported in both bills. Our Board of Trustees takes the responsibility of setting tuition very seriously. Our colleges and universities are fortunate to have received federal funding to support our students, help with additional operating costs, and cover lost revenue that has occurred over the past year due to the pandemic. These one-time funds, however, will not take the place of ongoing revenue that our colleges and universities rely on to support their students. Minnesota State needs ongoing state appropriation and tuition revenue to support the talent we need to deliver high quality instruction and services. I believe we all share the commitment to keeping all of our campuses open and financially viable. However, to do so, Minnesota State needs ongoing stable revenue to produce the graduates that our communities desperately need. We can't do that without your help. Since the pandemic started and Congress passed the first stimulus package, the CARES Act, I continually receive one resounding message from our college and university leadership across the system. We cannot use ongoing one-time federal dollars that have specific guidelines attached to them to supplant ongoing revenues. I fully understand that there is frustration related to guidance and timing on the federal funds, especially the American Rescue Plan. You are not alone. Every Thursday at 4 o'clock, Chancellor Malhotra's team has COVID calls with over 100 colleagues across our system to work through pressing issues, including interpreting federal guidance related to the availability and how to best utilize the federal funds for COVID relief. We shared with you earlier today our tracking on the CARES Act and the CRISA funds in regards to institutional aid and direct student aid. For the most part, you will see that the funds from these first two bills have been spent or are allocated. We simply, as I mentioned, have not received the guidance yet on the American Recovery Plan, the third stimulus package. We believe if their guidance is consistent with the first two bills, we will not be able to supplant tuition dollars with these funds across the board. In addition to institutional aid, We also want to stress there's been significant funding allocated from these funds for student aid, a total of $93 million in the first two bills. And we are expecting another $164 million under the American Rescue Plan for student grants. Chancellor Malhotra asked each institution to have a robust student consultation process with their student leaders to work through a process to get the federal student aid funds to students in a timely manner. This process will continue when we receive the American Rescue Plan funds. Our campuses continue to add additional funds and prioritize these funds to meet the most pressing needs. As of April 30th, $17 million has been added for additional student grants on top of the minimum amount required by the Department of Education. I mention this because I want you to know that we share your commitment to making sure students' needs are met across the state. With that, thank you, Chair Bernardi, Chair Tomasoni, and committee members for your time. I also want to thank Governor Walz and Commissioner Olson for their strong budget recommendations for Minnesota State. We are grateful for all of your support and would be happy to respond to any questions or provide additional information as deliberations continue. Thank you.
Thank you. On deck, we have Omar Aiden with with instructor Sean Peck. And we then, right now joining us is Paul Shepard. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, Chair Tomasoni, and members of the conference committee. For the record, my name is Paul Shepard, and I serve Minnesota State as the System Director for Student Development and Success. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today regarding the mental health language in the Senate bill. There was discussion and questions last week in conference committee regarding making sure students without web access still have access to mental health resources. The platforms we are exploring provide telehealth resources offer multiple options for access, including audio phone calls. Any technology platform that may be implemented would serve as a complementary tool to the services already offered on campus by faculty and staff. Students could work directly with these faculty and staff to identify the best option to access resources. Additionally, students who do not have access to other resources listed on a college or university website could call the faculty and staff who manage the list of resources to discuss specific resources a student may be interested in accessing and develop a plan for how the students can utilize these resources via phone. Supporting mental health is a top priority for the Minnesota State system. Advancing support for mental health has been a consistent priority, resulting in a number of initiatives, including a statewide mental health summit co-presented by the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State held this past fall. The statewide mental health summit brought higher education leaders and subject matter experts together from across the state to exchange practical strategies to advance mental health. In the wake of the summit, Minnesota State has identified several tangible steps we are taking to address mental health. A Chancellor's Fellow for Mental Health was selected to work with faculty, staff, and other key stakeholders to implement the effective practices identified as a result of the summit. These strategies include tools for assessing campus-based needs and capacity, forming a system-wide community of practice to identify and share evidence-based practices, and developing a culturally competent and trauma-informed communication plan that can be adapted by colleges and universities for implementation, focused on access to campus-based resources, stigma reduction, and the disparate impacts of mental health concerns for underrepresented communities. Thank you again for the opportunity to provide testimony today regarding Minnesota State's work on mental health.
Thank you. On deck, we have Mary Koser. And with us right now is Omar Aiden, and I believe the instructor Sean Beck is here as well. And if you could please proceed with your testimony, Mr. Aiden.
Hello, my name is Omar Aiden, and I'm a sophomore at Faribault High School. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to talk about the RISE program at my school, which these funds made possible. Before RISE, I just went to school, submitted my assignments late, and didn't have anyone to talk to about my classes. Now that I have RISE, I come to the RISE room, and the RISE staff pushed me to be my very best. I submit my assignments on time. When I need academic or personal help, I get it. It's been such a safe and welcoming place. When I wake up in the morning, the thing that makes me want to get up for school is RISE and seeing everyone's welcoming faces and smiles. RISE staff talk to us about potential careers we may be interested in. They bring in people of different careers and occupations, and it's always a success. Just recently, they brought in Monarch Healthcare Management, which is a healthcare company focusing on all different aspects of medicine and caregiving. I appreciated this experience because I'm looking to go somewhere into the medical field, and by introducing us to these companies, it gives us a lot of opportunities and options. RISE also helps us with career exploration. We have virtual college visits about once a week, and it's all different types of colleges, public, private, two-year, and four-year. We talk to people of all different careers and backgrounds, and RISE has me looking into my future and planning ahead. While I'm in the RISE room, I work nonstop, taking small breaks. When I need an academic or personal question answered, I get it answered with the help of the RISE team. Outside of the RISE room, I don't see many opportunities to interact with colleges. I personally don't feel very comfortable with asking the counselors career and college-related questions, but in the RISE room, I feel much more comfortable because I feel my voice is heard. More of what I am interested in is made available to me by RISE rather than something else that's bombarded on me. When I was new to RISE, I had a very hard time understanding two of my classes, and one of the RISE coordinators sat with me one-on-one and walked me through all the steps and directions I was supposed to take. Since that day, I've maintained an A in both of those classes. Additionally, RISE helped me become the outgoing and optimistic person and student that I currently am. Through the encouragement of the RISE team, I applied for a cabinet position in student council and got it. I also got an invitation to join the Honor Society at my school, and one of the RISE coordinators wrote me a letter of recommendation. I heard about the Black Student Union from one of the students in the RISE room, and I joined. RISE also pointed me to many doorways that I wouldn't have even heard of if it wasn't for them. I appreciate the RISE team and how they shaped me to be the person I am today, because without them, I don't think I would be successful as I have been this school year. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And I want to just extend an invitation. If Sean Peck, are you planning to testify today, or were you here in support?
I'm mostly in here just to support Omar and the other RISE students, although I will say that RISE is in year one of implementation, and it was made possible through ICAP funding. It's helped tremendously as we've tried to help students remove barriers to success in their lives, specifically students of color, those experiencing poverty, and those who would be first-generation college students. So mostly just a huge thank you to the committee and everyone else who has made this wonderful program possible. And shout out to Omar. He's one of our best and brightest.
I see that. Thank you very much to Mr. Aiden and Mr. Peck today. And now on deck, and I may not have gotten this right the last time, so on deck is Mary Kasur, and we actually have up now Alyssa Tomaszek. And if you, I don't think I had that order quite right the last time. Are you ready to testify, Ms. Tomaszek?
Yes, I'm ready. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, Chairman Bernardi. I appreciate you, and thank you to the committee members for allowing me the space to speak with you all today. My name is Alyssa, or Ali Tomaszek. I'm here to share a story regarding access to transcripts and financial holds with institutions. I am a 26-year-old student at North Hennepin Community College, and it is with pride that I say that I am a older and non-traditional student, as I've conquered many obstacles to be able to enroll. In 2013 is when I first enrolled to college at Minnesota State University Mankato, but unfortunately, due to circumstances involving my basic needs and mental health, I had to drop out. And I'm not alone when it comes to life circumstances preventing college success. And while I was enrolled, my outstanding tuition balance prevented me from using campus resources such as the food court or the bus system. I struggled to pay my rent and pay for groceries and pay for medical expenses with a job that only paid minimum wage. And tacking on the extra expense of tuition that I couldn't really afford was paralyzing. Access to resources such as the Emergency Minnesota Grant would have changed my life. And But unfortunately, however, I did have to leave. And after I dropped out of college, I got my life back on track. And the outstanding balance with the institution at the time had prevented me from being able to apply to other smaller colleges and institutions that may have offered a two-year degree or program. And I felt like my college experience was halted, it was insurmountable, and over. But after nearly 5 years later, some optimism and positive mindset, I've conquered battles with collection agencies and finally re-enrolled back into college, but with a little financial trauma. But I believe that a financial hold should not prevent students from moving forward with their life. Having access to transcripts would help students like me transfer to smaller and more affordable institutions, while also proving to potential employers that we have experience from our studies. Skills that I learned from universities, such as Spanish and CPR and first aid from the nursing program, would have been really beneficial for me in the workforce and getting a job. But I am very grateful for all I've learned about finances through my college career, but sincerely hope for future students that they don't have to struggle through the same obstacles that I had with trying to transfer their transcripts to a new school. And people's lives are constantly changing. I wanted to emphasize that from the past year, we've learned how uncertain circumstances can really be. So I believe that we should provide more opportunities for students who do succeed, as well as for students who choose to pursue a path in the workforce instead. And adopting changes to the policy regarding transcripts and financial holds would really benefit students' lives like me and future trade workers as well. So I hope you can see that there's no clear-cut path to success and that you can help me open doors for future generations. And thank you, Chairman Bernardi, for giving me this space. And thank you for the rest of the committee members as well.
Thank you. I want to let people know on deck is Sandra Oluwafemi. And with us now is Mary Kasir. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Chair Tomasoni, and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm Mary Moss Kozer and the Executive Director of Concordia Language Villages. Concordia Language Villages is affiliated with Concordia College in Moorhead. We are the premier language and cultural immersion program in the United States, and our culturally authentic village sites are located on 875 acres on the Turtle River Lake just northeast of Bemidji, Minnesota. Every year, approximately 10,000 youth and adults visit the villages, with a significant percentage of participants from the state of Minnesota, youth, families, school groups, and educators alike. We provide an unparalleled educational resource for the residents of our state. Beginning in 2020, we have also offered virtual villages, which is online instruction with real language, real culture, and real people. Virtual villages came about as a response to the global pandemic impact of this past year, but has proven highly effective. Since 2011, we have had over 1,800 Minnesota students in grades 3 to 11 participate in Language Village summer sessions with the assistance of an OHE summer enrichment stipend. In 2019, a total of 108 students took part in Concordia Language Villages and represented 26 counties coming from elementary and secondary schools, both in the Twin Cities metro area and throughout Greater Minnesota. Students typically range in age from 8 to 18. Last summer, only about a dozen students were able to take part in our virtual villages through the OHE summer enrichment programs. The number was much reduced, but entirely due to the significant impact of COVID on all summer programming. However, the good news is that already in 2021, for our upcoming summer programs, we have over 80 students participating who are taking advantage of OHE summer stipend funds. These $1,000 OHE stipends ensure that students without the requisite financial resources can attend Concordia Language Villages. The stipend completely covers tuition for a one-week virtual session or a residential program. And for those students who are interested in participating in four-week high school credit sessions or a four-week non-credit session, additional financial aid from foundations, grants, and other individual donations are provided as available. Overall, Concordia Language Villages distributes over $1 million in financial aid to these 1,800 students from underserved populations in the state of Minnesota. And if these OHE funds were not available, we would simply have less ability to fully empower Minnesota students to take advantage of this global opportunity so close to home. Exposure to language and culture at an early age prepares young people for a global future, whether it's to study or travel abroad or more fully engage with a multicultural diversity in their home communities. They leave with critical skills that foster successful matriculation into college and the confidence to embark on a global career track. And the OHE Summer Enrichment Program ensures that all students with a passion for world languages and cultures can have this experience. So thank you for your previous support, and we look forward to the continued support that your OHE funds have provided to us. Thank you.
Thank you. On deck, we have Jess Shymek, and then we have with us now Sandra Uluwafemi. Welcome to the committee.
Hello, Chairman Bernardi. Thank you so much for allowing me to testify today, and hello to members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Jess Shymek, and I am a member of AFSCME Local 4001, part of Council 5. And I am a college lab assistant at Anoka Ramsey Community College, where I've worked for the last 7 years. Thank you for hearing me today. I'm here today to express our thanks for the work that both the House and Senate Higher Education Committees have done this year and the efforts of the chairs of each committee to build an omnibus bill that protects students from increases in costs while balancing the needs of the University of Minnesota and Minnesota state systems so that they can continue to provide the programs and services students need to be successful. Unfortunately, we have significant concerns that the conference committee report will not adequately fund our colleges and universities while over-relying on emergency federal funds that could leave our college systems in a very precarious position, particularly Minnesota State. In addition, we are also concerned that the proposed tuition freezes or reductions could hamstring our colleges if we encounter some unforeseen problems this fall. If the incoming federal money, state appropriations, and tuition and fees aren't enough to fulfill the budget proposals for the U of M and Minnesota State, the systems are very limited in how they can balance the budget. To be clear, AFSCME does not oppose a tuition freeze over the next 2 years for public colleges and universities in Minnesota. As the state responded to the previous economic crises in 2007 and 2008, the legislature dramatically underinvested in our institutions of higher learning, forcing them to increase tuition at times over 10%. This was downright punishing to students, and we don't recommend that course of action at all. Many of us are students ourselves, and thousands of our members are parents of students that attend or will attend a Minnesota college or university. And what we are asking for is a significant investment by the legislature to hold both the students harmless so that they don't struggle with even more exorbitant debt, and while also making sure that our colleges have the resources necessary to keep faculty and staff so students can take the courses they need in the programs of their choice. Please carefully consider the consequences of passing a budget that relies so heavily on one-time federal aid and freezes or reduces tuition. We hope that you will consider making an investment to fully fund the budget requests of Minnesota State and the University of Minnesota, particularly if keeping tuition at current levels is a priority for the conference committees. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. And I want to say on deck is Jeff Wilson and Sandra Uluwafemi. I'm sorry that we got a little bit out of order here. Are you available to testify? Thank you.
Hello. Sandra Uluwafemi is actually my mother. I'm her daughter that she was going to testify for. So is it okay if I testify right now?
Oh, we would love to have you testify. Just please state your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Faith E. Mavin David.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Conference Committee, for this opportunity to speak on the positive impact of the Minnesota State Grant in my life. My name is Faith Mom and David, and I'm a rising second semester student currently attending medical school at the Ross University School of Medicine. Not only have I had the privilege of going through undergrad, but also the opportunity for it to be aided by Minnesota grants. But the impact on my life started in high school via the St. Cloud State University Summer Pipeline Camps. Rewinding back to my high school years as a rising sophomore in high school, I was presented the option through my academic mentor to attend St. Cloud Camp. After my first summer of attending, I continued to go back summer after summer, wanting to fill the void I did not know I had. The question is, what motivated me to come back? St. Cloud Camp prides themselves for giving youth the opportunity to channel their curiosity in STEM education. I have three C words to describe what I require from this camp and what I carry with me throughout my educational careers. My first one is collaboration. Before attending, I undervalued the power of collaborating with different individuals from all walks of life, whether it be from cultures, perspectives, different values, or educational backgrounds. A major objective of the camp was to work as a team to conduct research, write an extensive paper, and present our findings to our fellow campers, family, and friends. In addition, I was exposed to the art of networking and its benefits in regard with others seeking out necessary resources. My second word is curiosity. As a child, I was very interested in STEM and felt like I didn't have a medium to channel my desires. St. Cloud Camp was an outlet and space for me to be comfortable to ask these type of questions and to start thinking more critically. Third word, creativity. I was given a foundation in how to conduct research, but also the flexibility to make it unique to my questions and curiosity. Lastly, courage. As a Black Nigerian American child of immigrants, underrepresented student, I have faced educational disparities, and the St. Cloud Camp aids in decreasing the gap for people of color like myself. It gave me the confidence, it gave me the courage to believe in myself that I am capable and able to pursue a career in STEM, and therefore the fire I needed to go through college and now medical school. Coming back to present day, I am now in medical school, starting to start my own research task force with other fellow students. Due to the foundation established in my previous camps, I'm able to go into this project with a different level of confidence and knowledge. I am beyond grateful for the lifelong friendships I required and for all the individuals who play a role in making the St. Cloud Pipeline Camps happen. I can never forget this experience. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I just want to make sure that we have your contact information for our legislative committee administrator. So thank you very much for testifying today. Now with on deck, we have Huang Murphy and we have Jeff Wilson in front of us right now. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Wilson, are you available to testify? We can come back.
Madam Chair, it looks like he just dropped off the call. He might need to jump on again in a second.
Okay, we will come back to him. And then we've hung Murphy, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. So thank you, Chair Bernardi and Chair Tomasoni, members of the committee, and thank you to the staff who have worked this year on several of the provisions that I'll be speaking about shortly. My name is Huang Murphy, and I'm the founder and executive director of a small nonprofit called Foster Advocates. I'm here to urge you to support the higher education goals of foster youth. Many people believe that the most difficult moments of a foster youth's life are the moments before they enter foster care. Despite the pain of being separated from their families or the sting of abuse, the most difficult challenges are actually the ones that come after. The worst is the indifference that fosters face when they turn 18 and must face life on their own without anyone to guide their path, alleviate their burdens, or to support their dreams. But we can build a better future for fosters by providing them with support in pursuing their college and career goals. The fostering higher education provisions create existing supports to simplify the process and provide a small scholarship to foster youth who might need it in pursuing their higher education goals. In fact, it's also a good deal for the state of Minnesota. We will save about $1 million in societal costs for every foster youth who graduates from college. This is a good investment for our most vulnerable young people, and it's a good investment for Minnesota. And please remember that foster youth are our children. They became ours when we separated them from their families. We owe them a duty of care just as strongly as we do for the children in our own homes. Fosters have to have grit to make it, but other kids, they get to have dreams. Please do what you'd want for your own children and your own students. Please accept the provisions as laid out in the Senate omnibus bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you. On deck, we have Dr. Robert John Peterson. And with us, and I'm sorry we didn't give you a heads up, is Paul Spies. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chairs Bernardi and Tomasoni and conferees. My name is Paul Spies with the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers in Minnesota. Earlier this session, both of your Senate and House committees heard the Increase Teachers of Color Act, Senate File 797, led by Republicans, including co-sponsors Senator Rarick and Senator Jasinski, along with Senator Claussen, and House File 1041, led by Representative Keeler with Democratic colleagues. Both Senate and House hearings included powerful testimonies from several diverse teacher candidates about the importance of financial support to complete their student teaching. Links to video testimonies from additional 10 other candidates comprise one of the documents in your virtual packet for today. In addition to these testimonies, the Increased Teacher of Color Act has been endorsed by a wide range of 55 organizations that don't always agree on other education issues. One big reason why Minnesota is falling short of meeting its higher ed attainment goals and why we have persistent and the nation's worst opportunity and achievements gaps that have big costs for individuals, society, and the economy is that the percentage of teachers of color is so low in our state. This I say during Teacher Appreciation Week. So may we all appreciate the teachers that got us here wherever we are in life. Research is clear that teachers of color and American Indian teachers are good for all students and they close gaps. Yet in contrast to increasingly diverse K-12 student population whose percentage grows each year and is currently 36% of all students in the state, our state's teaching forces remain stagnant at around 4 to 5%. If all students had equitable access to diverse teachers who reflect their diversity, Minnesota would have 23,000 BIPOC teachers now. 23,000. Instead, we only have less than 3,000. We're in a deep hole and a crisis. The state and its students and their families need your leadership to increase the percentage of BIPOC teachers starting with supporting BIPOC teacher candidates to complete their preparation programs. Increasing one percentage point will require a net gain of 630 BIPOC teachers, yet approximately just 370 BIPOC candidates complete student teaching per year, and they represent 12% of all student teachers. In the pipeline are approximately 1,500 BIPOC candidates enrolled in teacher prep programs prior to student teaching, looking for scholarship support. These data with numbers by institution from the most recent Title II report is also a document I submitted in your virtual packets. So I'm here to ask for your support for sections endorsed by the coalition, which are all specified in a document in your virtual packets named Coalition Endorsements with Higher Ed Omnibus Comparison. These sections we support in the side-by-side are framed in purple boxes with our logo. They come from the House, which is proposing $9.4 million over the biennium, with important policy provisions to support virtually all underrepresented candidates with grants during student teaching, and a few hundred additional candidates with very important new aspiring educator of color scholarship program. This amount is 1/4 of the $36 million proposed in the Increased Teacher of Color Act. It is less than 0.3% of the total higher ed funding, and it is just 1.7% of the February forecast total for programs administered by the Office of Higher Ed. Please demonstrate bipartisan leadership and prioritize House proposals that are needed to start increasing the percentage of teachers who more closely reflect and are more effective in teaching all of our students. Thank you.
Thank you. And now we have, before we proceed with Dr. Robert John Peterson, I believe we have Jeff Wilson back online.
Yes, thank you. Sorry, I had a technical glitch at the worst time there, but I'm back. Appreciate it.
Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Tomasoni, and all committee members. For the record, my name is Jeff Wilson, Executive Director of College Possible Minnesota. Thank you all so much for the time you've put into this process. We deeply appreciate being included in the bills, and thousands of students across Minnesota will benefit from your hard work. At College Possible, our students' average family income is below $40,000. Last year, 99% of our students were accepted into college, and they are three times more likely to graduate than their peers from similar backgrounds. Thank you for your support, and thanks to your support, College Possible students will have the coaching and support they need to go as far as their talent and motivation take them. We know you have a lot ahead of you, and we appreciate all you do for students in Minnesota. We're grateful for our inclusion in the bills, and thanks again for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. On deck, we have Dr. Bruce Corey, and with us now, we have Dr. Robert John Peterson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members. My name is Leotawa Dr. Robert John Peterson, and I work with the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership as a program consultant. I come before you today in the spirit of encouragement and gratitude and thankfulness for the work that the committees have done over the past, 4 or 5 months. I'm encouraged by the work that's been happening and the conversations and the partnerships that have been built over the past 8 months. The Minnesota Education Equity Partnership has been working in partnership with Minn State, the University of Minnesota, Minnesota Private College Council, of course, the committee chairs and the committee members. I'd like to thank you all for the opportunity to present and provide testimony, I think on three different occasions now. I just want to reiterate the importance of elevating equity and equality and racial justice within the higher education space here in Minnesota. I know that times have been tough in the past 12 months with the dual pandemics of systemic racism and COVID-19 and the coronavirus. I just want to encourage everyone in the space right now to continue to fight for equity for our students, not just our students of color, but all students. Equity is not good just for some students, it's good for all students. And I'm looking forward to ongoing conversation and partnership and convening folks around that notion of equity for all. And so with that, I just want to say thank you again for the opportunity to provide testimony and look forward to partnering with and continuing the conversations around equity and more specifically race equity in higher education in the coming years. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. On deck, we have Priscilla Mayowa, and with us now is Dr. Bruce Corey. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, and thank you, Chair Tomasoni, for this opportunity to testify on this Omnibus Higher Education Bill. My name is Bruce Corey. In my testimony, ALANA, African, Latino, Asian, and Native Americans are the students I'm referring to. In testimony provided to multiple committees in the Minnesota legislature, I estimated the economic cost of racism to be at least $287 billion. Hence the need to be intentional in closing the racial education gaps. The ALANA youth in Minnesota represent an asset base of $1.5 trillion in Minnesota, reflected in their potential lifetime earnings if all completed a bachelor's degree. Please consider this important asset under your stewardship when you consider investments and policy decisions. We also have to keep in mind that at least 29% of the students in higher education from the ALANA communities, and I estimate that they contribute at least $1.6 billion in annual tuition payments to Minnesota higher education institutions, making an even stronger case for equity in investments and policies. The ALANA Brain Trust proposed the Minnesota Solution, four set of comprehensive strategies that include funding and investments in scale and scope, multi-tiered student support systems, culturally intelligent learning environments, as well as representation in faculty, staff, and leadership and the sharing of power and governance. And finally, a focus on outcomes and metrics disaggregated by Alana groups. So if we look at Center 5, 975, we'll see that the total funding with a specific Alana focus only reflects 7% of all spending in higher education in Minnesota. And this includes spending on the state grant program. So in terms of scale and scope, to address racial economic disparities, the funding should be closer to $1 billion, with an emphasis on increasing funding to those programs where money goes directly to students, such as the state grant program and other programs. There's very little funding for multi-tiered student support systems, which includes academic support, wellness services, and emergency support. And there's very little investment in improving the learning environment to make it more culturally intelligent. And there needs to be an intentional effort at inclusion in all policies and programs offered at a higher educational institutions and in legislative funding decision. Such language needs to be inserted into the omnibus bill. And finally, we need an intentional focus on graduation and career outcomes disaggregated by Alana groups. Thank you for considering these suggestions.
Thank you. On deck, we now have Axel Kylander, and with us now is Priscilla Mayowa. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, Chair Thomasonia members. For the record, my name is Priscilla Mayowa, and I'm the president of LEAD-MN. Thank you again for providing another opportunity for students to speak before you today. I also want to thank you for putting students at the center of your decision-making this session with policies and investment in mental health and basic needs. Students like Amanda, M-State Detroit Lakes, returning adult learner and student parent who has battled balancing college affordability, buying food for her family, and finding affordable and accessible internet. Student like Axel and Anoka Ramsey Community College and LEAD-MN president-elect who grappled with balancing his mental health and his academic success after the loss of a parent. Students like Marcellus, a St. Paul College student who experienced housing insecurity after he was unable to secure a lease and had to couch surf to keep a roof over her head. And students like myself, a North Hennepin Community College student who has known the pain of going hungry while trying to focus on classes. What we have tried so hard to make clear this session is that we are the face of today's Minnesota's college students. We're non-traditional, first-generation, low-income students of color, veterans, and parents. We're struggling with mental health, college affordability, and basic needs long before the pandemic. But now the pandemic has placed a giant spotlight on all these issues for all to see, and we need the visibility to lead to action. After the Great Recession, states around the country, including Minnesota, disinvested in higher education, and we're still seeing the impacts of that today. There was a time when the state covered two-thirds of the cost of higher ed for students. Now we're faced with another inflection point. Will the state invest in the colleges that can build our state back and into a successful 21st century economy, or will it continue down the path of placing more of the burdens on students? A recent study by the National College Attainment Network found that 60% of our two-year colleges in Minnesota are unaffordable for low-income students receiving financial aid from the federal government. We urge you to invest more in our community and technical colleges and to provide stability for students through a tuition freeze. Thank you again for allowing us to share with you the student voice this session. We hope that as you move forward in finalizing the omnibus bill, you will include the provisions that our students worked so hard in this session around mental health, basic needs, and hunger-free campuses. These provisions, along with Z degrees, workforce scholarships, improving access to transcripts and childcare grants, and emergency grants, will help make the final omnibus bill truly student-focused. Thank you.
Thank you. Now with us, we have on deck Sam Parmecker, and we have now with us Alex Kylander. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, Chair Thomasoni, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Axel Kylander, and I'm the Vice President of LEAD-MN. I'm here today to express support for the provisions regarding student basic needs and mental health included in the Senate Higher Education Omnibus Bill. Throughout this legislative session, you have heard the voices of students calling for change, for responsive legislation to meet the many challenges our community faces as we strive for better futures. Within the two omnibus bills you are working to reconcile, there is great potential to create a better future for us all. Among the most pressing challenges students contend with are struggles with their mental health and in maintaining their basic needs. from battles with depression and anxiety to keeping a roof over their head and a full stomach. The health and safety of students is put at risk by these gaps. Campus resources are generally scattered and often difficult for students to access or navigate. There's stigma and shame attached to these painful experiences and a terrible sense of loneliness. Both omnibus bills on the table provide significant funding to address student basic needs and mental health in the Minnesota state system. However, the advantage of the language in the Senate omnibus bill is that it provides meaningful steps for exactly how this funding can be used to support students. These proposals were developed by students for students, based on the needs we ourselves see for our community. They are founded on research into what works best to support students and what is both ambitious and practical for the funding in the bill. Peer-to-peer support, accessible resource hubs, and support triggers based on financial aid are just some of the meaningful strategies the Senate bill allocates funding for. Implementing practices like these will help students access the support systems they need. It will help them be a part of a destigmatized community, an attitude of wellness and success through their time in college. It will help students be safe and healthy as they pursue their degrees, and in turn, it will help them graduate. Funding for basic needs and mental health is a fantastic step to support students, but it works by far best with a clear, well-founded vision of how that funding should be used. The provisions in the Senate omnibus bill on these issues are grounded in the understanding of what works, consultation with data, history, and the voices of students. They are the legislature's best path forward in supporting mental health and basic needs for students. And I urge this committee to adopt the Senate bill's language on these issues for the final higher education omnibus bill. In closing, our students are grateful for your recognition of the struggles they face and for your commitment to mental health and basic needs funding in both the House and Senate omnibus bills this session, and hope that you will move forward in adopting our student proposed solutions as well as ongoing funding for these issues. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. And on deck, we have Mark Grant, and with us now we have Sam Parmecker. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, Chair Bernardi, Chair Tomasoni, and Conference Committee members. My name is Sam Parmecker, and I'm the State Government Director for the Minnesota Student Association, the undergraduate student government at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I'm here today to speak in support of the Hunger Free Campus Act, and I'm grateful to see it included in both the House and Senate bills. In the interest of time, I'll keep my comments brief, but I've submitted a more detailed written testimony to the committee. Much of the conversation today has rightfully centered on higher education affordability. I'll reiterate what other testifiers have said and emphasize that basic needs expenses like food, housing, and mental health treatment have fueled the college affordability crisis over the past decade and put higher education out of reach for a growing segment of Minnesotans. The Hunger Free Campus Act is a critical step to addressing the unacceptably high levels of food insecurity that permeate every campus across the state. The language incentivizes institutions to take steps to create basic infrastructure for hunger prevention programs, following the lead of other states like California and New Jersey. Differences exist between both versions of this language, and I want to briefly speak to those. The House has appropriated nearly $500,000 to fund this grant program for the biennium, which we believe represents a strong commitment to ensuring funding is available to as many institutions as possible. It also sets up an annual $223,000 appropriation for the following biennium, and I want to stress that ongoing funding is crucial to the long-term success of reducing campus food insecurity. I strongly urge the committee to adopt the finance provisions from the House bill. I also want to talk about the impact of the policy language that sets up this grant program. In this respect, we believe the Senate bill excels. Importantly, this language clarifies the Hunger Free Campus designation criteria to require colleges to notify work-study students that they may be SNAP eligible and connect them with resources to apply. Nationwide, 60% of SNAP eligible students are not enrolled in benefits, largely due to the fact that they aren't aware of their eligibility. So this is a really important practice to increase enrollment numbers. The Senate language also reduces the institutional matching requirement to 25% of a total grant, lowering barriers to access for these crucial grants. Additional Senate language instructs OHE to prioritize grants for schools with the highest number of Pell-eligible students, ensuring that grant money is going to schools with the highest need. We urge the adoption of the Senate's policy language to make this program as strong as possible. I'll wrap up my comments and again note that I provided written testimony that goes into more detail. Thank you, Chair Bernardi and Chair Tomasoni, for making food insecurity a priority in your budget this year, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. We have Jonathan Bone on deck, and with us now is Mark Grant. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Chair Bernardi, Chair Tomasoni, committee members. For the record, my name is Mark Grant. I'm a communication studies instructor at Dakota County Technical College, and I currently help direct the governmental relations work on behalf of Minnesota State College faculty. We're the union that represents more than 4,000 college instructors, counselors, librarians on 39 campuses across Minnesota. Happy Teacher Appreciation Day, and thank you so much for the opportunity to share our testimony with you, and of course, thank you so much for your hard work this session. It's fair to say that in my 22 years of teaching, this last year has been by far the most tumultuous. Through a global pandemic, incidences of civil unrest, both nationally and quite literally in my own backyard, and nationwide conversation on civic responsibility and justice, Minnesota State College faculty have been singularly focused on our mission to provide all students, regardless of who they are or where they come from, with a world-class transformative education. It was just last March, faculty scrambled to move courses, some of which were never intended to be taught online, into a distance learning format. A colleague of mine at DCTC quickly purchased video cameras and equipment and turned his own garage into a lab, each morning taking his wife's car apart and then putting it back together in the afternoon. At the end of the semester, I reached out to ask him how he was holding up, and he said, well, the good news is I got all my students graduated and I am in fact still married, but honestly, I'm not entirely sure how much longer I can keep this up. I have far more examples of this than I do time today, but it's suffice to say that many of our faculty fundamentally changed how they did their jobs to make sure that the needs of their students, the campuses, their communities, and the industries and industries continue to be met. And while I'm sure some of these changes are going to outlast COVID, I also believe that one truth has emerged from the last year, and that's our students desperately want to come back to our campuses. The question then is, what type of campus are they going to be coming back to? Are they going to come back to campuses with fewer course offerings, diminished programs, no counselors, and fewer faculty? Because those are the very things that the state appropriation funds. You know, in the early days of the pandemic, I was told by a legislator to prepare for a big hole in higher education, and without significant federal intervention, that hole would most likely turn into a grave for many of our campuses. But here we are a year later, and with the help of that intervention, we're currently climbing out of that hole, while also getting much needed financial assistance to students. So while I'm grateful for the assistance provided through the three federal relief packages, and as you've already heard from Minnesota State, the Office of Higher Ed, as well as other, these funds are not the way to move forward. To be clear, faculty are committed to addressing college affordability and the growing debt burden being carried by our students. It's why you're going to continually hear me advocate that we, at minimum, return to the statutory language of two-thirds appropriation, one-third tuition, a threshold that we haven't met for over two decades. But to return to those historic levels of funding requires an investment on the two-thirds side, not simply an adjustment on the one-third side. I believe that by investing in our campuses, you not only make meaningful steps in addressing college affordability, but you also assure that when all of our students do come back, they come back to vibrant centers of teaching and learning. With that in mind, we urge you to support the Minnesota State system in line with their request and the governor's recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you. We have Matt Shaver on deck, and with us now is Jonathan Bone. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni and conferees. My name is Jonathan Bone. I represent the Interfaculty Organization. We're a union that represents approximately 4,000 faculty, coaches, counselors at the seven state universities. Due to the time limits, I'm just going to focus my comments on a couple key areas, state appropriation and tuition. Since 2003, with a few exceptions, our state government has failed to maintain a level of investment in higher education to cover inflationary increases on campuses. Due to the uncertainty of the state's budget in the middle of a pandemic, the IFO supported a status quo request from the system of $75 million in state appropriation and 3% tuition increase each year. To be clear, even if fully funded, it was not enough to invest in new programs needed in our communities. It was simply a status quo budget. The IFO proudly did our part to reduce the deficits on our campuses. In September 2020, we communicated to the chancellor that we would take a self-imposed pay freeze in the 2021-2022 academic year. This concession has saved our campuses millions of dollars. Yet here we are again, in front of this conference committee, begging for less than what we need, as our campuses have already begun to plan for cuts to campus services, faculty, athletics, student support services, and more. As state government leaders have shifted the cost of access to higher education from taxpayers to students and families, the legislature has found an easy target by blaming tuition as the culprit for increased cost to students. Our institutions have access to two sources of revenue, if state appropriation goes down or doesn't keep up with inflation, tuition must go up, otherwise cuts. State universities have been cutting repeatedly since 2003. The IFO alone represents 400 fewer faculty than we did in 2017, a 10% reduction in less than 5 years. Besides the low O&M appropriation numbers, except from the governor fully funding the request, our main concern with the two bills in front of you is that tuition seems to be viewed in a vacuum. Both the House and Senate have tuition provisions included, hoping it will reduce costs for students. Unfortunately, the real impacts to students will be negative and will limit the opportunities and reduce the quality of the education that, they'll be provided. We respectfully ask you to consider stopping or ending the legislative trend of the last few biennia in which you all have been deciding what is best for our campuses. Please let those conversations happen locally with the people our communities have entrusted to work collaboratively in the best interests of the students, the institution, and the region. Local control will provide better outcomes for students and communities. Of course, it pains us to sit in front of you and defend any tuition increase, but the reality is we have no option. In our experience, students do not prefer a tuition freeze or reduction if it meant they would lose the tutoring center, the class sections they need to graduate, their athletic team, or the possible elimination of their academic programs. On May 14th, 26 tenured faculty at MSU Moorhead will be laid off, and three more faculty and counselors at St. Cloud State will lose their jobs. Those are tenured faculty. Programs with students across the state, including programs vital to advancing equity and inclusion goals of both the state and the system, are being shut down. In the last 5 years, 53 permanent faculty lines at Winona State have been lost to attrition. MSU Mankato is planning for 25 permanent faculty lines to be reduced to attrition next year alone. St. Cloud State has laid off 11 tenured faculty, including two mental health counselors, who will lose their job next week during one of the most intense mental health crises of our generation. And ultimately, these are good-paying jobs in small communities that are now gone, and the broader community and the economy will bear the brunt of those losses. And almost all these cuts were announced prior to COVID. The saving grace in this discussion over increasing tuition is that most vulnerable students in our college and university should have the tuition increases offset by modest increases to the Pell Grant or an increase in the living and miscellaneous expenses in the state Minnesota State Grant. And now the impacts of COVID have hit our campuses, and the federal government has tried to do their part to help protect campuses and students. And in your bills, you asked our campuses to use federal funds to balance budgets. And I just have a quick analogy I want to offer that I heard from a campus president that I think makes a lot of sense. A homeowner has suffered a fire that's destroyed part of their home. The homeowner receives an insurance check for $50,000 to clean up and rebuild the portion of their home that was damaged. The insurance money doesn't add a new bedroom or remodel the kitchen. It only restores the home to how it was before the fire. And the check is only written one time. Hearing that the homeowner received a check for $50,000, the homeowner's boss tells him, hey, now that you have a $50,000 check and you're rich, I'm going to reduce your salary by $10,000. As a result, the homeowner can no longer pay their mortgage. When the homeowner is a university, one of the largest employers in a small community, the ramifications to the community are devastating. The universities have used these funds as intended to fill deficits due to the pandemic. There is nothing left to cut tuition or pay for tuition freezes. Any statutory limits on tuition would be an unfunded mandate. If the will of the legislature isn't going to provide enough new funding to cover increased fixed costs, and then our hands are tied on tuition, students ultimately end up hurt, jobs are lost, communities are worse off, and the state ultimately suffers. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With us, we now have, before we go to our next testifier, I would like to let Denise Dietrich know that she's on deck. And with us now, we have Matt Shaver. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Bernardi, Chair Tomasoni, members of the Higher Education Conference Committee, good afternoon. My name is Matt Shaver, Policy Director at EdAllies, a statewide education advocacy nonprofit. We partner with educators, families, and communities to ensure that every Minnesotan has access to a rigorous and engaging. Thank you for the opportunity to share our thoughts on the higher ed omnibus bills today. I want to echo a couple of things that have already been mentioned today, that just one, our teacher workforce in Minnesota is overwhelmingly white, and two, that all students benefit from learning from a diverse group of educators. And there are a number of great initiatives included in these omnibus bills seeking to address the discrepancy between the reality of the status quo and what we all want to be true for our kids and educators. These provisions include the Aspiring Teachers of Color Scholarship, expanding the state grant program to students who have taken developmental coursework, concurrent enrollment grants, hunger-free campuses, and student teacher grants. These are all worthy programs deserving of significant investment of state dollars in the final bill. While we pursue these avenues, we also need to continue to refine existing programs. By better and more equitably targeting resources, we can align their purpose and statute with their impact in practice. The changes to the Teacher Loan Forgiveness Program included in the Senate omnibus consolidates and concentrates resources to support teachers where they are needed most acutely. The current definition of shortage area inadvertently qualifies pretty much every teacher in the state, which makes the pool really wide for these incentives and ends up diluting their impact. According to the Teacher Shortage Loan Forgiveness Program annual report from 2021, which I know we all read from cover to cover, in 2019 and 2020, there were a total of 3,927 applications for the funds. 3,527 of those applications came from white teachers. In the last 2 years, there have been a total of 1,687 awards received, and they have overwhelmingly gone to teachers with elementary education licenses. The current system privileges white teachers and crowds out the people and licenses our schools and kids need most right now. It isn't working. The proposed changes would mean that my elementary teaching license would not qualify me for any loan repayments, and that's okay. While I was teaching, I applied for that program every year and never got selected because the pool was too broad with the current definition of shortage areas. So this might mean that white teachers don't necessarily get to be at the front of the line for a program or a benefit, and we'll be okay. Additionally, the identified licensure areas of special education, English as a second language, physics, chemistry, math, and middle level science have all been shortages for more than a decade and are all statewide shortage areas right now. It makes sense to hold up those licenses specifically as a route for new teachers to pursue. Including this language in the final bill means prospective teachers with student debt can count on opportunities for debt reduction if they pursue those fields specifically or if they're teachers of color, regardless of where they teach or what year they apply. And that's a good thing and something Ed Allies is proud to support. I want to thank you all for your time and thank you all for your public service.
Thank you. On deck, we have Sam Walseth, and with us now is Denise Dietrich. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Tomasoni, Chair Bernardi, and members of the Higher Education Conference Committee. My name is Denise Dietrich, and I represent all 333 locally elected school boards throughout Minnesota as the Minnesota School Boards Association. Today, I am also testifying on behalf of the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and Minnesota Rural Education Association. First, we want to commend you for the collaborative effort and leadership demonstrated in both the House and the Senate higher education omnibus bills and those items that will proceed into Senate File 975. We would also like to express our appreciation for the number of provisions addressing teacher shortage and increasing the number of teachers of color in Minnesota's K-12 schools. We believe these meaningful investments will help Minnesota effectively attract and retain high-quality teachers, which is one of the best indicators of improved student achievement. Also, the research is clear that all students benefit from experiencing teachers of color in their classrooms. In addition, we want to thank you for the provisions addressing the chronic opportunity gap in Minnesota. Specifically, we appreciate that you have included MSBA in the group of stakeholders to help determine measures for the access to the for the direct admissions program. We believe this program can provide a streamlined process to a currently daunting process, especially for first-generation college students. So time is short, and you have heard a lot of testimony today. So I will conclude my comments and refer you to the detailed letter that we have submitted to the committee by the above-mentioned groups. Now, my colleague, Sam Walseth, would specifically like to address a couple of the provisions in the letter that I referenced. Thank you.
Thank you. Now we have on deck Trey Feuerhelm, and with us right now is Sam Walseth. Welcome to the committee.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and members of the Higher Education Conference Committee. I'm Sam Walseth on behalf of the Minnesota Rural Education Association, and echoing the testimony of Ms. Dietrich and the letter she just cited, we also want to echo the support for the Teachers of Color initiatives, the loan repayment and student teacher support programs that are in process in the higher education bill. But I want to specifically direct your attention to another very important issue that is at stake, and that's the importance of concurrent enrollment. The high school college partnerships that exist between almost every public school district and many of our Minnesota colleges and universities. It's easy to talk about the financial impact for students and families, and of course, we can get bogged down in inter-system revenue concerns. But more importantly, though, is the impact these partnerships are having on breaking down racial inequities in our educational systems. According to a recent report on rigorous course taking by the Minnesota Department of Education, between the 2016 and 2018 school years, while concurrent enrollment programs saw an 8% increase in participation by all students, participation rates increased by 14% for low-income students and 33% for students of color. Research routinely shows that high school students who gain access to college courses are more likely to attend and complete college coursework. To help high schools do their part, several thousand teachers have attained graduate credits that are needed to meet HLC and NASEP accreditation requirements for concurrent enrollment partnerships. This session, we are hoping to formalize the concurrent enrollment teacher partnership, made up of school districts, public schools, cooperative educational entities, and higher education systems in the E-12 bill. And to help us augment the success of these programs, we're asking you to adopt the House language expanding the allowable uses for concurrent enrollment development grants that are administered by the Office of Higher Education. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Oh, thank you very much. And now with us is Trey Feuerhelm. We'll see if my 3 years of German helped me with this last name. Welcome to the committee.
Yes, thank you, Chair Bernardi. You had that spot on. German works well. So hi, everyone, and hi, members of the conference committee. My name is Trey Feuerhelm, and I am a second year currently at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus. I currently serve as the president of our Swipe Out Hunger chapter, which is a nonprofit organization committed to fighting food insecurity across college campuses. I also serve on the leadership team for the Nutritious Youth Food Pantry, which is the free on-campus food pantry here at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I work directly one-on-one with students who struggle to face food insecurity and struggle to afford food. During the time that I have served in the various organizations, I have seen hundreds of smiles on faces, yes, even if underneath their masks, of students who were receiving free to-go meals or free food from the pantry. The joy, relief, and sense of security that food brings to so many students should be seen and felt across all college campuses in Minnesota. And this is possible. By passing the Hunger-Free Campus legislation with the combination of both the House and Senate inclusions, I fully support Sam Parmakar's testimony that he laid out written and orally, we can tackle student hunger. An investment in students now is an investment in Minnesota for generations to come. If students can financially afford, physically nourish, and mentally refuel themselves in order to succeed in college, there is no doubt that Hunger-Free Campus, with the House appropriations and Senate appropriations combined, would be an investment for all of Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Now that concludes our public testimony for today. I just want to make sure that I called on everyone that was planning to testify today. I just want to pause here just to make sure if somebody needs to speak up to let me know, that would be appreciated. Well, I want to thank all of our testifiers today, and their passion and commitment and leadership to student success is really, really appreciated and recognized. And I also want to give a special shout out to our students who shared their stories, challenges, things that they have overcome, talked about helping to make it safer, healthier for all students to be able to be sure they have a roof over their head, food in their stomach as described, and the mental health treatment they need. And I want to thank you for all of you for your leadership and helping share your stories. And I want to shout out to our teachers and wish them a happy Teacher Appreciation Day today. Now what we're going to move forward in our committee hearing today is have members ask questions that they may have of the testifiers. I want to let everyone know that Nikki Oliver, the Grants and Government Relations Manager, is on hand from the Office of Higher Education. We have Nicole Whalen with us, a research analyst from the Office of Higher Education. Betsy Talbot, the Manager of Licensing and Registration from the Office of Higher Education. And Pat Benner, the legislative representative for AFSCME. So I would like to put that out there. I'm going to get my screen so that I can see if anyone has raised their hand. That'll take just a moment here. So members, are there any questions that anyone would like to ask of our testifiers today? I have Representative Cleavorn. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. This question is to the IFO representative, Jonathan Baum. In listening to his testimony and talking about the supports that the systems need, I'm also wondering how they feel about the investments for the teachers of color that are in our Senate and House bills. Thank you.
Jonathan Bowen, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Cleavorn. I appreciate you asking, because that was something that I had to cut from the testimony to try and save time, and I would like to say that we're proud supporters of those initiatives. We're proud of Professor Spies, who has been a leader of the coalition, and we understand better than anyone that in order to get more teachers of color, we have to have more faculty of color in our universities to make sure that as those teachers work their way through the licensure process and their university education, that they can find some faculty that look like them as well. So we've been working hard internally to develop an equity and inclusion strategic plan to make sure that we are retaining and recruiting as many faculty of color as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up, Representative Cleavorn?
Yes, please. I just want to make sure that I heard the number correctly. Also to Mr. Bone, did you say that the state colleges and universities have cut more than 400? Did you say 400 professors since 2017?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. We represent in 2017, we represented over 4,400 total faculty, and our number as of right now is just under 4,000. So we have had a reduction either through retrenchment, non-renewal of fixed term, or non-renewal of adjunct faculty.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Representative Cleavorn, any follow-up?
No, thank you. That's all for Mr. Baum. Thank you.
I see no further questions. I just want to put out there, are there any further questions before we proceed? Seeing none, I am going to Chair Tomasoni add any closing remarks he has and to see if what our plans are for tomorrow.
Madam Chair, let me add my Happy Appreciation Teachers Day to the teachers also. And I want to thank everybody who testified today. I think we heard some clear opinions about which bill was better for people on different subjects. And it's encouraging to hear some of the things we heard, because it might make wrapping up this bill a little bit easier. And Madam Chair, as we discussed last week, until we actually come up with a target, we've done a pretty good job of going through the bill and comparing the provisions of each bill. And I don't think that us just sitting in a conference committee and talking more about it will get us anywhere. So I don't have any plans to call a meeting tomorrow. And I don't know if, what you want to do after that if we don't have a number. So at this point in time, I'm kind of content to have offline discussions with you about the bill and wait and see what the leadership comes up with as far as a target is concerned. I don't know what you think about that plan, but for now, we won't be meeting tomorrow.
Thank you, Chair Tomasoni. And I want just to mention to people that may be viewing that we have been told, and I don't, and Chair Tomasoni, I don't know if you've been told this as well, that the goal is to get targets to us by May 7th through the 10th. And I am hoping that that happens sooner the better. And I appreciate updating about tomorrow. Hopefully we'll be able to figure out if there's ways in which we can move forward before the target. We'll have to see if that's possible. We've done a lot of our work already. So thank you for updating on us tomorrow, and we will hopefully get a target very soon.
Well, and Madam Chair, I agree. I think that there's places where we can come to an agreement and potentially make them part of the bill without too much discussion. But at the same time, unless we got a number, most of the policy has something to do with the finances also. So once we get a target, I think we'll be able to move relatively quickly. So
thank you, Chair Tomasoni. So members, with that, I want to again thank our testifiers today. We appreciate their testimony and for being here with our committee today. And thank you, members and people who are part of this conference committee today. With that, the meeting is adjourned.